Welcome everyone to the Retail Corner podcast from Proxima 360. The purpose of our podcast is to bring a relaxed and educational environment to discuss the current retail landscape, best of breed products, and retail business best practices. You will always find us talking with business users, technical resources, and retail experts on how they are and where they are headed.
Everybody, and welcome to the Retail Corner podcast. I am here with Eric Choquette. He is the founder and main person over there making decisions over at Link Financial. It's a kind of a pay by bank operation. And so, Eric, welcome to the Retail Corner, man.
Thanks for having me.
Good. So people who aren't familiar with it or anything else like that, can you walk me through your CV a little bit?
Sure, happy to. Started my career at Blackstone in the restructuring group there, doing restructuring investment banking, and then worked for a bit in the hedge fund industry, covering a broad range of sectors, including financials and European financials, and then have founded several fintech and related software companies. So the first one was a company called Adam Finance in the investment research space. Have helped start another company in the sales tax space, And a few others, which are, you know, sales tax, obviously very relevant to retail, as I'm sure, folks know. Yeah. Started the current company I run and am CEO of, called Link Money, which is a US-focused pay-by-bank platform serving enterprise merchants, generally with some sort of digital offering. They can also have on-premise sales and things like that, but usually there's a mobile app or an e-commerce website or a digital interface to pay. And what we offer is a very seamless end consumer user checkout, where a customer can select their bank and enter their credentials or authenticate with Face ID. And that's pretty much it. And once we get that information, we tell the merchant that the payment is successful or not. And that's pretty much it. So we've basically abstracted away all the complexities of ACH and bank payments, and we can talk more about why that's so complicated in the US versus other markets. So we've abstracted all that away. And for the merchant, basically, this pay-by-bank product functions like a card. From their experience, the user has a very seamless UX. And the kicker, of course, is the merchant generally saves anywhere from 60 to 80% versus their cost of processing on cards.
Makes sense. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say,
I just have a lot of questions about pay-by-bank stuff. And so I work with a company called Proxima 360, and we're in the back office and everything else of a lot of different retail companies. And I've actually had conversations about pay-to-bank and how to integrate it into different companies, and making sure that there's kind of two sides to that transaction. There's the retail side. There's the back office side that, I mean, we can figure out those integrations. That's not the hard part, you know? And so making sure that those integrations are talking to the right financial pieces within the company, mm-hmm. and making sure that it's accepted as a tender, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you've got the consumer side that needs a little bit of education as well. Right. Mm-hmm. And so when we're talking about pay by bank, mm-hmm. how much do you approach that consumer side, how do you approach that consumer side when it comes to education? Because when we all go to mm-hmm. the register, it's like, okay, I mean, nobody writes checks anymore, really. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know, you're paying by card, you're paying by Apple Pay, and now you have this pay by bank piece. Mm-hmm. And how are you educating that? How have you seen success in education, I guess?
Yeah, so I'll actually challenge one of the points you made. So I actually think, so the tech and building pay by bank, there's no such thing as pay by bank in the US in terms of an actual payment method. So it's actually insanely hard. And the reason for that
that's good. So
we can do both. We can talk about the consumer piece, which is hard, but the actual pay by bank piece and the payments piece. So in Europe and markets like Brazil and India, there's real time account to account money movement, right? So you have UPI in India, you have Pix in Brazil, and you have open banking and real-time payments in all the EU markets and the UK. In the United States, we do not have that. There is now FedNow, which is barely supported by any banks. But basically, mm-hmm. FedNow and RTP are only credit push account to account. So what that means is the consumer needs to authenticate it and approve it every time. So there's no such thing in the United States as real-time debit pull, which is how it works in every other market in the world. Nor is there a plan to have that at any point in the current roadmap. So the reality is that because there's no real-time account-to-account money movement in the US, pay by bank, it needs to actually be built. Like someone has to come in and figure out what rails to move the money on and do the front end work and all that. And there's also no actual open banking in the United States, right? So in Europe, by law, you have access to someone's bank account information if they give it to you, right? So there's open APIs and you can access that. It does not exist in the United States at all. And so the reason you've never seen pay by bank in the US historically is because of these issues. Like it's hard to do.
Right. Okay.
And ACH, which I'm sure folks use for rent and you know utility payments and things like that, is extremely not suitable for any sort of real-time purchasing use case, whether that's e-commerce or you know paying your insurance premium or whatever. Because basically the issue with ACH is you give someone your account and routing number. I have no idea if there's money in this account. It takes 4 days to clear. And then there might be a reversal or return, and there's tons and tons of fraud. So any merchant who has historically, you know, you look at neobanks as an example, who's tried to use ACH for funding, have blown up and lost insane amounts of money on fraud and other issues. So that's why, so just setting the groundwork, that's why ACH.
That's absolutely, because I was thinking it was more of just a tender, and there is much more behind the curtain.
Not at all. And so basically what we do is, we've built everything. And so what happens is we have the API linkages to the various banks. We cover 95% of US bank accounts, all the major banks. The consumer authenticates on the front end with either CREDS or Face ID if they have the mobile app, and that's supported for all the big banks. So very seamless wallet-like experience. And then magically we say yes or no, and the transaction is good, just like a card, right? So it seems super simple.
That's the secret sauce. Yeah. Okay. Exactly.
Under the hood, basically what we're doing is we're pulling in the consumer's bank account information, which they've allowed us to do. And so that obviously means account and routing number because we ultimately have to move money, but it's much more sophisticated than that. We're pulling in profile information. We're pulling in real-time balance. We're pulling in the history of the account because we want to make sure that there's sufficiency of funds so that when we actually go to move the money, there's money there and that this person's not a fraudster because it could look like there's money in the account, but it could be a weird deposit. It could be coming from Venmo and hasn't settled, or there could be money there. And the second you go to pull the money, they call their bank and say the account's been hijacked, right? And you get a reversal. With ACH, it's you know, it's hard to kind of adjudicate that favorably if there's, you know, if someone claims an account's been hijacked. So you need to prevent fraud at the outset. And so that's the information we're looking at in real time. And then we, you know, tell the merchant payment approved or rejected. And then ultimately at that moment, we're guaranteeing the funds to the merchant. So the merchant knows, just like a card, money good. And then we settle usually within 2 days, most of the time within 1 day. So just like cards, same thing. And for the merchant, we usually charge them in the low 1% range, which is, you know,
that's much less,
80% less than they're going to pay with cards. And then of course we go and move the money. And if there's a reversal, we handle all of this and we've abstracted all this. And the merchant sees it, you know, the payments in a portal, just like they would with another payment method. So that's how it works under the hood. And that building that, the you know, the front end linkages, the merchant portal, the actual money movement and bank integration, and then the decisioning and anti-fraud layer is like really, really complicated. And that's why you haven't seen merchants do it, because it's taken us tens of millions of dollars in several years and people who are experts in this. So that's the context. In terms of the consumer side, which is a great question. So we focus on merchants. Obviously I said enterprise merchants, and we generally focus on verticals and areas where there's some repetition of purchase between the consumer and the merchant. They know each other. They're usually buying, you know, a few times a year at least, maybe it could be more. And we usually like purchase amounts that aren't like $5. We like things that, you know, at least 20, 30, 40, 50 plus. So that could be high repeat e-commerce. Okay. It could be, you know,
you're not just using this for buying cars. You're not just using it's accessible to everyday purchases as long as.
We don't, you know, if it's a very large amount, like you're buying a car online or something like that, right? There's usually financing, or you can wire, you can wait for the funds to clear, right? So in those situations, it doesn't make sense. But in a lot of situations where it's luxury, so we're going to be launching soon with a major jewelry company in the US, like with those situations where, you know, it could be $1 to $10K, let's say, or we work with StubHub, which is a ticketing platform. So they're, you know, the average purchase there could be in the hundreds or a couple.
Yeah, StubHub has taken a lot of my money. Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
So in those situations, right, even if you're not buying an expensive ticket or a ring, obviously every day, even that one purchase is sufficient to make the cost savings of 3% versus 1% very attractive for the merchant, right? And then of course you flip in and say, okay, I'm buying from, you know, let's say I'm a customer of Macy's or some other e-commerce website that I buy, or, you know, pet food or Chewy or whatever it is, right? In those verticals, I'm probably buying more regularly, right? A handful of times a year, at least, maybe more, probably spending $50, $100 a pop. And so again, in those types of setups, the economics, again, for the savings for the merchant make a lot of sense, right? So first principle is we focus on the verticals and the types of purchase situations where the economics of the savings make sense. We don't go after coffee shops. We don't go after random little e-commerce websites where you're buying $50 one time and never coming back, right? That's not suitable. So in those situations, those merchants really understand the LTV of that customer and the value of that savings over time for a cheaper payment method. So they're highly, highly incentivized to push adoption. The second piece is in those verticals, the merchant usually has some leverage. And so what I mean by that is if it's a marketplace, I pick my ticket already, right? If it's, you know, an e-commerce situation where, you know, buying a ring or a lot of these things, like so the consumer knows the merchant, they've already picked their product in a lot of cases and they buy from them regularly. And those merchants tend to also have good rewards programs and loyalty programs. So there's a lot of tools besides just putting this in the checkout flow and saying it's a preferred payment method and doing marketing and things like that. They actually have a lot of economic leverage or rewards leverage that they can use to push adoption. So that's how, you know, that's how it's set up from a consumer standpoint. And of course, you know, economics, giving the consumer some cash back or rewards is obviously a great way to drive adoption, but there's actually a lot of tools that the merchant can leverage first before even going to money to get people to, you know, not use debit cards or credit cards or what have you.
This seems like a good marriage with e-commerce. Are you seeing what kind of challenges are you seeing coming into e-commerce versus brick and mortar transactions?
Yeah. So we focus on, most merchants and retailers, especially these days, are obviously omnichannel. Usually the stack will be, there's a website, usually a mobile app, and then obviously there's in-store. With those kinds of merchants, and it's just the way they run their businesses too, like we focus on the e-commerce website and the mobile app first, obviously, to integrate this. It's much easier. The friction and flow is much better, obviously, digitally to some extent. So that's where we focus. For in-person use cases, and there are examples, you know, we have a partner in the auto body shop space. Those are obviously done in person, those transactions, but the flow can be texting a person a link and then they go through the same pay by bank flow I described earlier, and they just do it on their phone or they do it on the iPad in the store. So that could be done in commerce situations.
You've removed a lot of roadblocks kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it doesn't run through a POS system or anything like that. Obviously we're not going to target situations where, it's like a checkout line and it needs to be super fast. Sure. And people aren't using, you know, if they have the mobile app, right. And that's already the pay by bank payment method is saved and that's the default there. And that's the objective, right. Saved. It functions just like a card. Right. And obviously they can check out with the mobile app, whatever, but we're not going to, you know, try to have someone complete the pay by bank flow the first time in a quick checkout line. Right.
Like you said, it's more of a personal transaction. It's more of it's more of something that you're going out to find, not just an everyday coffee shop kind of thing, you know?
Exactly. But a lot of these, even these in-person situations, a lot of that volume these days is actually run through, mobile apps, right? You think about like a Starbucks, or you think about a lot of these fast food restaurants or gas stations, like a lot of that volume is people checking out with basically their mobile app. They have, you know, a saved profile there and they have a saved payment method. And so in those situations, it's super attractive because that merchant can basically target that customer and tell them to change their saved payment method. And then it's pretty much a one and done situation. And now you've locked in 70% reduction in cost of processing for every future transaction, pretty much for that customer.
Now you've mentioned 70% just now. You mentioned a couple of the numbers earlier. Like this is some pretty heavy cost savings on the retailer side, right? I mean, can you kind of walk me through that a little bit? Like, cause that's a significant savings over credit.
Yeah. I mean, so the issue with credit, obviously, and debit cards is, right, there's the meat of the fee is interchange. So even if you have multiple PSPs and you fight them down on their costs, you're going to save 10 basis points, right? But you can't get under interchange, right? That's set by the card networks. And what's happened over the last several years is Visa, MasterCard, and Amex have all raised their interchange rates. Amex actually just added more fees for their premium cards. So if someone shows up with a platinum, but that's on top of the interchange that they raise. So it's actually like we're seeing in certain verticals like luxury and ticketing and online travel agencies, you know, the pain is really severe in terms of merchant margins getting hammered because people, you know, they can't control if someone shows up with a, you know, an Amex or one of these cards and then they're getting charged 3.5%. So it's just destroying people's margins. And so, you know, Pay by Bank puts the power back in the merchant's hands to can kind of control their cost of payment acceptance and can to gives them leverage to actually lower those costs. And the beauty and the reason it's much cheaper is very simple. You can't get around interchange, obviously, if you're accepting cards. Like that just is what it is. We don't process on card networks, right? We don't process on card rails. All these other payment methods, Apple Pay, you know, Google Pay, BNPL, under the hood, most of that is pretty much all on card rails. So that's why, you know, BNPL is and the repayment for generally speaking for the loan on the BNPL side is charging people's debit and credit cards, which I know sounds insane because you're then adding fees on fees, but that is how it works. And the wallets are the same thing, right? They're basically an additional fee for the wallet on top of card rails. So ultimately what we're doing is, you know, we have costs in terms of, you know, paying the banks for access to consumers' information through those APIs. And obviously we have to move the money and there are situations where we lose money and we decision wrong. But the TLDR is because we're moving ultimately on ACH rails, it's way cheaper. And so we've built this entire layer to make ACH work in this kind of real-time context. Obviously, it was never meant to work that way. And so we're making kind of legacy rails work in a new context. And the result of that is we can charge the merchant, you know, 1.2%, 1.1% in that range and be profitable. And obviously, the merchant will save a lot of money and they can pass some of that to the end consumer.
So, I mean, you are bleeding edge, cutting edge on this. And so when you're making these legacy rails, old dog, new tricks kind of thing, what kind of like regulatory compliance are you just butting up against? Cause there's got to, I know that with banking, there's all sorts of things that are probably standing in your way. What do you, how are you getting around those or how are you dealing with those?
Yeah, so we have great major bank partners. We're actually going to make an announcement about that in like the next week or so. So we're a third-party sender. You know, we had to do several, you know, year basically integration to do that and put in compliance processes and set up KYB frameworks and all of that to basically be able to ultimately move the money and have an FBO and move it you know from the consumer to the merchant. So you know that is a real process and is not trivial and. You know, building directly into a large financial institution to be able to do that is hard. But the beauty is because we're working, you know, you've seen some neobanks, for example, struggle and there's been a lot of regulatory issues there in terms of serving consumers, right? The beauty of what we're doing is, you know, that we're working with major household name merchants, right? So there's not much KYB. I mean, you're talking about huge brand names. Obviously, we have to still do KYB, but there's not really a question of that. Most of the issue that a lot of these fintechs have run into, especially serving consumers, is that you know, it's really hard to do KYC on these people and they're not doing it properly. And so that's been the regulatory clampdown on like banking as a service and all this stuff is coming from lack of compliance with respect to KYC, which is in this case, not an issue here because, you know, these are major merchants and you know, we have our processes in place, but like we don't have to deal with, you know, tens of thousands of random people showing up and trying to deposit money in a new account, right? Like that's hard to do, right? So it's understandable why there's issues there. And that's why regulators have basically said, we don't want this. We want, you know, traditional banks, there's a reason why it takes a bit of time to open an account. They actually do their diligence. They want to know where the money's coming from. Sure. And so in this context, it's very different. So it's obviously hard to work with banks and make, you know, ACH files and the way all this money is, you know, basically these are like batch text files that are sent with ACH instructions. Like that's how ACH actually works under the hood, literally. But you know, we've made it work and that's both the challenge of doing this in the US. Yeah. And then on the other side, obviously the beauty and part of the moat we have is that this is really, really hard to do. It's much easier to do this in Brazil where there's real time instant, you know, account to account money movement and they're not moving money, you know, sending TXT files between, you know, banks. Like that's so, but so, the so point
do you
is
think,
to make,
do you think
the
that
point it, is to make it work?
Do you think, yeah. So do you think that, American banking and everything else like that is going to catch up in the next few years? What do you see in this space that's going to happen?
No. I don't think it's going to change. I mean, the adoption for RTP. Yeah. The adoption for RTP and FedNow has been really poor, for a bunch of reasons. It's expensive. Doesn't really solve, the credit push doesn't really solve a use case because you're sending a decent amount of money. You're just going to wire. It's not that friction heavy to do a wire. So it's not clear exactly the problem it's solving. And I think, you know, there just isn't, first of all, these things take forever. Like just FedNow took like 10 years plus, right? Like, and it doesn't, even as of today, very few banks even support it. So even by the time it's actually rolled out, if that now happens, like, you know, you're talking about maybe a 13 year kind of development cycle. So
the gears of banking roll slowly. Yes.
Yeah. Because the US, you know, there's a bunch of reasons for this, but obviously the banking market in the US is super fragmented. We have like, you know, 10,000 banks. You look at the UK, there's like six banks really that matter. Yeah. Brazil, same kind of thing, 6-7 banks. So in these highly concentrated banking markets, yeah, it's easier to, you know, you do six, think about it. You do six API integrations basically, and you have open banking in one of these markets, basically, right? Here you have 10,000 banks, little credit unions, and those small banks, like banking is highly regional in the US. That's how it developed. A lot of these, you know, charters are state charters. And so, yeah, similar to insurance. And so like, local and regional banking is going to be a thing in the US probably forever. And so the reality is that because it's going to be a fragmented market, doing 10,000 API integrations and getting 10,000 banks to turn on FedNow is very hard. And it's important because a lot of people use their local lender or like their local bank. People like that, right? You know, even the big banks don't have them. You know, you add up the big banks, the market share is still, you know, not that much in percent versus other markets. Like, and so that ultimately makes, you know, innovation hard. And so I think, people always get pumped about, you know, these new, there's so much hype on any of these new open banking, FedNow. I think the reality is that ultimately the key to building in this space is to make things just work in the current regime and reality, smoothly.
Yeah. You guys aren't waiting for that. You guys aren't waiting for that 13 year adoption or whatever else like that. You're like, you know what? These are the tools we've got. Let's make it work for people now. Kind of.
Well, cause the merchant, I mean, look, the merchant suffering is now. Like, you know, what are you going to tell the merchant? Great. You're going to suck it up and your margins are going to get crushed.
I'll see you in a decade. No.
Yeah. 13 years and 13 years from now, you know, either FedNow or crypto or some other technology we haven't heard of is going to solve this pain point. Like it's not a reality. So merchants need to operate in the here and now. And the pain point is high cost of payment processing and you know, shrinking margins because of inflation and interest rates and other things. And so, yeah, if there's a way for them to offset that with a technology that is easy and seamless and doable, and, you know, they don't have to care about the machinery under the hood, then, you know, they're very open to it. And that's why we're seeing a lot of excitement from merchants about pushing this. And, you know, I think the consumer adoption point is, you know, I think if you think back, like, you know, and this is obviously a question that, you know, merchants and folks always think about, but I would say think back to wallets, you know, like, you know, Apple Pay and things like that. Wallets were big in every other market before the US, like Asia. And I remember like 10 years ago, people would be like, oh, wallets will never become a thing in the US because people just pull out their card and they don't care about a wallet. And sure enough, it became a thing in the US. BNPL was exactly the same thing. BNPL was big in every other market, especially in Europe before the US. People are like, nah, it's never going to really be a thing here. It became a thing. So I would say if you look at the history of payments innovation in the United States, it basically follows this pattern every time, which is it's just other markets on a lag. Maybe that lag is like 7 years, probably, depending on what it is. And so even go back another one, the chips and cards.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Remember that? That was a thing in Europe like 10 years before the US. People are like, why would you need the chip in the card? You can just swipe. And then sure enough, you know, so the point is every time it's the same story. And I think the difference here will be, you know, in Europe, because payment processing costs are regulated and they're low, the pay by bank adoption has not been driven by cost saving. It's really just like, it's an easy UX, it's secure, which is in the US will be true too. Our UX is great. Right. It is more secure than putting in your card information. So UX and security are two great value props to push the consumer. But the difference is in Europe, the merchant was relatively agnostic because it's like, yeah, pay by bank's a bit cheaper, but cards are pretty cheap and regulated. So it's not like a huge deal for them. Here, it's going to be very different. Like the merchant incentive,
it's going to be very attractive. Option,
yeah. Yeah, is like very, very different here because of that.
So if I'm talking to somebody and they ask the question, okay, we're thinking about a bank, like a pay by bank type option. What questions do they need to be asking themselves? Where do they need to be putting their thought processes? Is there something that they need to be thinking about even now before they roll anything out? Is that what foundation are they needing to put in place?
Yeah, I would say the first maybe step that they ought to think about a little bit is just how has been their integrations historically of adding another payment method. I think we've built this to suit. It's very familiar to payments teams, especially enterprise companies that have done any sort of payment integration, whether a PSP or an alternative payment method like PayPal. It's very similar. So that's like the first principle is like, hey, what's that timeline look for like for us? How long does it take us to integrate? And then most of the work is really on the back end, making sure it works with the merchant's ERP system, real-time inventory management, reconciliation, all of that, which we can support to some extent when we do. But obviously the merchant has to do a lot of that work to make sure it works with their system. So I'd say that's like the first piece is assessing that. How much is it going to cost? How long is it going to take? And then, the second piece is once they decide to pursue it is working with us on an initial rollout plan and thinking about how to promote it and how to position it versus other payment methods and kind of who to target. So that will depend on the type of merchant. Obviously, the more sophisticated the merchant, then the less they'll need us to help with that. A lot of these merchants have very sophisticated payments optimization teams and customer retention teams and loyalty teams. And so really the goal of this is to embed the savings of this payment method with the work those teams do and to drive it using those tactics of, CRM and positioning on the website and incentives and rewards. And that's really the goal. And obviously we have a playbook and we have thoughts based on the data we've seen in different industries. But like a lot of times, that's the beauty of working with these enterprise merchants. They're really sophisticated. They have teams of people, doing all of these functions just to drive, a few basis points of adoption one way or another. So that's why we're most focused on enterprise merchants, because this is, as you said, like, a novel payment method. And so like, you can't just put it there and then be like, that's it. obviously there's a lot of work
out there.
Yeah. Same thing with BNPL. Like these things are, Apple Pay, any of these things, it's an evolution of adoption over time. And, you don't just drop something new and it all of a sudden, it's very rare that, you create something and then people just use it.
We all know people love change. And so that's getting people to adopt is one of the most important things the new kind of payment. And so we're running low on time, but I want to ask you one quick question. If I were just now starting out and maybe getting my degree or, just starting on my journey and I wanted to get into and be kind of be where you are, be the leader of bank payment stuff. So what advice would you give yourself?
I think the most important thing is earlier in your career is just working at a company that you feel is doing interesting things, where you're going to learn a lot and you're going to surround yourself with highly competent and hardworking, exceptional people. I think like first and foremost, like learning, especially early in your career, learning compounds. And so you just want to be in a great environment where the company is generally doing interesting stuff. It could be in many different spaces. It doesn't have to be, even if you want to end up in payments, let's say you don't necessarily need to start in payments, right? It could be software. It could be, building rockets. It doesn't necessarily matter. I think what's more important is, you're in an environment where you're given a lot of rope, you're learning, and you're surrounded by, people who are experienced and really hardworking and have good intensity. I think that is probably the thing I would optimize the most for early on.
Kind of picking which garden you want to grow in, kind of thing. That's
exactly. Yeah. You'll take the better quality garden, even if it's maybe different, the vegetables you don't like or something like that.
Pushing that metaphor. Yeah, sure.
Exactly.
But cool. Okay, perfect. Well, Eric, thank you for joining us on the Retail Corner. We'll put all of your links below. You are obviously the expert in this, and I appreciate you stopping by. And hopefully we'll talk again maybe 6 months to see how we're going.
Awesome. Thanks for having me.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
If you would like to be featured on our podcast, please email us at podcast@retailcorner.live or visit our website, retailcorner.live. Looking forward to having you as our guest on our podcast, and thank you so much for listening.